It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. And so
hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a journey to take today, one of getting healthier and learning a lot that the mainstream media and the government is not telling us. We're going to learn about the real reasons we're in Syria. They have nothing to do with the pap that you've been given by the New York Times or CNN. That's all disinformation propaganda. This is very important. You have not heard this before. Also, we are lectured all the time by the super rich. They fly off to Davos in their economic forum meetings, an exclusive hotel in Geneva, all in private jets. And they're telling us how we should live, the sacrifices we should make. Well, we have a little commentary for them. You'll hear it in about 15 minutes. But we're going to start today with the latest on health and healing, and this is from the University of Copenhagen, and it's about fat cells. Now, it turns out something new. It only takes 24 hours for a so-called precursor fat cell to reprogram its epigenetic recipe for developing into a fat cell. Now, this change occurs when the cell is put into contact with a fatty acid palmitate, or the hormone TNF-alpha. That's according to a study conducted by researchers at the Novo Nordisk Foundation for Basic Metabolic Research, University of Copenhagen. What's this mean in lay language? Well, the precursor cells are cells that have not yet matured to undertake a specific function in the body, for example, the function of a muscle or a fat cell. And palmitate and tumor necrosis factor alpha are able to disturb the development of the cell, causing it to develop into a dysfunctional fat cell later in its life. In particular, this reprogramming is found in almost all obese patients, especially those suffering from type 2 diabetes. So people are exposed to palmitate throughout food, especially the food that contains high levels of saturated fat. That's all your dairy products, all your meats and palm oil and trans fats, French fries, the oils in pizza, a steak, a bologna sandwich. That's where all this comes from. And TNF is an inflammatory hormone that is secreted in the body during illness. So let me make this real simple. Every time you eat anything unhealthy that contains what I just mentioned, the hot dogs, French fries, hamburgers, sausages, pizzas, you are programming the cells in your body, the precursor cells, to become obese cells. So we are creating our own epidemic of obesity and diabetes. And by the way, this is not the only study. There are several epigenetic studies that have shown that human precursor cells have a memory of past environmental exposure. But until now, no one has been able to identify the factors affecting the reprogramming of precursor fat cells. It would be like you going home, and home was very wonderful when you were growing up. The moment you see that home, the moment you walk in the door, your entire biochemistry begins to shift back to what the memory was, the epigenetic memory, when you were growing up there. But let's say you go home and you had not a good childhood. You were traumatized by different things or abused in some way. The cells in your body will absolutely go right back into high defense, high stress mode, even though maybe it's an empty house. Maybe everyone's dead. Maybe someone else bought the house. It wouldn't matter. That's the power of memory in cells. And every one of the cells in your body has multiple memories. In fact, every time we think of something, we create a new memory. And memories are always floating. They're always adjustable. That's why memories are not always accurate. Not today, but I have a program on transhumanism and the latest in bioengineering, artificial intelligence, where, believe it or not, they can now, they've perfected putting, with intense effort, reprogramming your memory. Now, they claim that it's supposed to be for those who've had bad memories to put in good memories. But the very fact that they can reprogram your memory means that they're wiping your old memories clean. But how do they know how to just reprogram bad memories? When you start getting in the hippocampus, you have no control over which cells will be affected. It's like chemotherapy. We're going to kill 100 cancer cells. Yeah, I'll bet you will. You're also killing 10,000 to 100,000 healthy cells at the same time. But that's where the science is now. Now imagine how many people would line up. You'd have, I'm going to say, at least half to three-quarters of the American population would sign up for that. Oh yeah, I don't want those memories anymore. So wipe them out. That's where we're at now, not the future. In any case, so everything follows the same law of the universe. Every single action, word, feeling, every breath you take, every scent you smell, every feeling you experience has a memory. And then every time you repeat that, you create another memory. How many memories do we have? Well, for every 10 years of life, you lay down about 100 million mental impressions. So if you're 50, you get about 500 million. Now you get the idea why it's so difficult for so many people to change, because they're only living about 3% of the time, maybe 4 or 5 if they're really focused on conscious awareness the moment they're in. Almost everything we're saying and feeling and thinking and doing during a day is from our memories. And so much of that is epigenetic. So when you think something from the past, if you eat something from the past that wasn't healthy, the body remembers it, starts creating more unhealthy fat cells. Just saying, meditation can make a difference. In fact, from Michigan Technological University, that's exactly what they were able to prove, that meditation could help anxiety and cardiovascular health. Almost sounds like a late night infomercial. In just 1 hour, you can reduce your anxiety levels and some health problems with your heart. That's a recent study with 14 participants, shows preliminary data that even a single session of meditation can have cardiovascular and psychological benefits with, if you have moderate anxiety. And this is something that could really make a difference with people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the ways that I share a protocol, or part of the protocol, for people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, not just returning soldiers, but also people who've been in abusive relationships, have the very same identical impact post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's just say you're a woman or you're a man and the person you were with betrayed you or lied to you or hurt you in some way. You then begin to suffer from this over and over and over again because you can't change anything. It's done. All you can do is think about it and then beat up on yourself. Unfortunately, that's what most people do. Why didn't I see this? I should have known it. There's, you know, my intuition was telling me one thing, but my desires told me another. Well, pay attention to the future. Because if you've been in any kind of abusive relationship, you could benefit from meditation. because meditation can elevate the feelings of anxiety, angst, rage, resentment, jealousy, envy, all these negative emotions. It can elevate the discourse so you're no longer allowing those to impact you. You can just let them be what they are, just statements from the past, and say, not today. Today no one's manipulating me. Today I'm not being abused. Today I'm making healthier choices. And I don't feel any stress. Now if I want to go back and start reliving those memories, oh yeah, back comes the stress. It's all there waiting. It's just waiting. You know, it's like, don't pick up the rock. Could be a poisonous snake underneath. No, I got to pick up the rock. No, you don't. Yeah, I do. I have to re-image my stressors 200-300 times a day. No, you don't. You don't. And meditation can help you stay focused where you're at. Just 30 minutes a day. Also from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, culture shapes the brain. How reading changes the way we think. And I'm not talking about reading over the internet. From a research perspective, reading and writing, I consider a fascinating phenomenon. After all, the first writing systems date back to less than 6,000 years. I mean, that's a blink of an eye in the timescale of human evolution. And how the human brain is nonetheless able to master this complex task is a key question. And current topics of scientific interest include exploring the differences between practiced readers and illiterate individuals, and the consequences for people with reading difficulties, as well as the impact of poor reading and writing skills on global democracy. Why? Reading and writing is something most of us take for granted. Grabbing a pen to jot down something, or using our smartphone to read, which it's doing for us, or answer text message or an email, is something to which we don't give even a moment's thought. Reading and writing, however, are amazingly complex skills. As the Max Planck Institute of Psycholinguistics showed, that the effects of literacy on cognition and brain functioning is substantial. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Language, Cognition, and Neuroscience. Quite simply, I'll boil it down. To read and write, the brain must coordinate numerous perceptual and cognitive functions. Now, these include, for example, basic visual skills and phonological perception and long-term memory and working memory. And that's why it takes years of practice for reading and writing to become so deeply ingrained as to be effortless. And learning to read and write, in turn, modifies the structure and function of the brain. Let me repeat that, because that's the takeaway message. Learning to read and write will modify the actual structure and the actual function of your brain. And researchers in this area focus upon two fundamental questions. What conditions need to be in place for us to be able to learn to read and write? And how does this complex skill affect our perception and cognition? And that's what the key is. Because people who are unable to read analyzes images differently. And they work with what they have, which is their gut instinct. And this is true around the world. So comparing illiterate individuals and adult readers highlights repeatedly just how much learning to read changes our brains. So we need to go back to reading, not over the internet, not Kindle, getting a book and putting it in our hands and reading it. And then writing. Begin with short writing. Like, what do I want to obtain today? And then at the end of the day, what happened to me today? And were there any remarkable moments, challenging moments, highlighting, you know, wonderful moments, creative moments? insightful moments. What was my interaction with people? Could have been better. Was I patient or impatient? Did I acknowledge someone else? Was I patient enough to listen to them talk without interrupting them or talking over them or talking at them? Did I stay neutral at any point today? How did I feel being alone? Did I say, this is great? I'm not engaged in mindless chatter. By the way, the one thing that I do not have in my life is mindless chatter. If someone can't keep their mouth shut and just has diarrhea of the mouth, well, I'm not going to be the person they should be spending time with. I appreciate when people have something to say, providing that it is actually something to say, some relevance. But there's people who just engage in nervous conversation nonstop. And that in itself is very stressful. But if you sit down and you write things out and then read back what you've written, does it make sense? Now, how can you expand on it? So you start to build on that writing skill. And the next thing you know, you are using a greater vocabulary. You're looking for different words to express yourself. You're thinking more deeply. You can go back and read books that maybe at one time were too challenging. Go back and read, you know, Nietzsche. That's a good place to start. He'll throw you a 120-mile fastball. But you've got to be challenged in order to grow. Otherwise, you have a very limited way of dealing with life issues. And we're not teaching our kids today to read and write. Not the way they were. Not the way we were taught. Here's the downside of that. Last evening, I had returned from our retreat. It's over. And once people, some of the people were there, want to share with their experience. And I said, okay, let's give it a week so you can put it in perspective, make sure that the benefits of being there are continuing and growing. And I'm sure that they will be. So about a week from now, we'll have them, about five or six of them on, because there were some things that occurred that were so remarkable that a doctor who was there came over to me yesterday and says, I don't know what happened. All I know is I was here, I saw, I don't understand it, and you won't talk about it. And I said, that's correct, I'm not going to talk about it. Why not? Well, because it's a gift. If you're given a gift, you know, do you go out each day and say, son, I don't know why you're in the sky. What is your purpose? You know, I don't need to know a thing about the sun to appreciate the warmth that it gives. I don't need to have anyone explain to me the smell of honeysuckle or jasmine. At the bottom of it, I believe life was not meant to be figured out. It was meant to be lived. And those who spend their whole life searching for the answers, never find them. Because there's always one more question, one more question, one more question. That's kind of a linear fill in the blanks. In any case, we had this discussion. I actually had this discussion with a parent. Well, you know, so I'll tie two things together. So when I came back last night, I wanted to see how they were handling commercials, specifically not the programs. I was just interested in the commercials. Because I was going to do an analysis and I was going to write a little essay about what's wrong with commercials. And it's called Talk Back to Your Commercial. And commercial after commercial last night was about Echo and these little devices that you don't have to do anything. Echo, find me the Righteous Brothers. Suddenly, which Righteous Brothers? We have 22. That love and feeling. Then it's suddenly there. How many people live in Nigeria? 83 million. Okay. So now you don't have to do any reading, no research, no writing. It's all done for you. The new smart car can track everywhere you're at any given moment. A commercial with her, I guess it was the wife playing an astronauts in space and calls down for the computer in her car to unlock the door so her husband can get in the car. He lost his keys. You see, everything is sold to us as if we need it. It's enhancing our life. It's making everything better. Is it? What is the downside? Let me give you a little idea. For every time you're using any internet for any reason, they're logging it. They, meaning the platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, they have a record of it. Now, the latest is Yahoo. And Yahoo now wants you to sign an agreement for their new system, which is taking place the old system, where they actually state that they want to have complete access to all your banking records, all your credit card information, everybody that you owe money to, who it's for, how much it is, how much money you have in your bank, your savings, your 401k, every single financial thing about you, they want to know. Now, here's the question. Why is it the vast majority of Americans have no problem with that? Almost all young people say, fine. Because it doesn't stop there. They want to know every single thing about you. Why? Because they're going to sell it to a third party. Who? They don't tell you. What are they going to use it for? To try to say something. If anyone in this audience has ever used porn for the last 20 years, they know what porn you saw, what you repeatedly saw, what your fetishes are. They have a psychological profile on you. You didn't know that, did you? Wonder how someone could use that against you. Every photograph, email, letter, every comment in every telephone conversation. Let's just say once you were talking with someone, a friend, family member, and you got a little heated. And you raised your voice and you said something inappropriate. They have that. What could they do with that if they took that out of context just to show that you were volatile? And yet the average person does not feel that that is a problem. So everything in your life now is collected. Do you have a problem with that? If you do, what is the problem? And if you don't, why don't you? That's our talk back question for today. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. So the takeaway message is, if you're not reading, read. If you're not writing, write. And it might be a little rough at the beginning, but you'll get into a rhythm where you look forward to reading and writing yourself. Finally, from Pennsylvania State University, it's about mushrooms. Mushrooms are often considered only for their culinary use because they're packed with flavor and flavor enhancers, and they have gourmet appeal. That's probably why they're the second most popular pizza topping next to pepperoni, a meat that never goes bad. Wow. In the past, food scientists, like myself, often praise mushrooms as healthy because of what they don't contribute to the diet. No cholesterol, no gluten, low in fat, no sugars, low sodium, calories, low. But that underestimates what a mushroom is good for. In point of fact, you have medicinal qualities in mushrooms because they're loaded with these healing properties. I'm not talking now about protein or B-complex or fiber. I'm talking about immune-enhancing sugars found in the cell walls called beta, B-E-T-A, glucans, glue, G-L-U, cans, C-A-N-S, and other bioactive compounds. They've been around for centuries, but now we're starting to appreciate just how valuable this fungi, and a mushroom is a fungi, really is. They're now being used in preventing Parkinson's disease and even Alzheimer's disease. And they're rich in selenium, glutathione, ergothionine. All are known to function as antioxidants that can help mitigate oxidative stress and help slow down the aging process. And one, I'll just call it ergo, E-R-G-O. It's actually ergothionine is an antioxidant amino acid that was initially discovered way back at the beginning of the 20th century, and it is one of the building blocks of protein, but it has a lot of other qualities to it. But they should be heated, ideally shiitake mushroom, reishi mushroom, white bell mushrooms, oyster mushrooms. Heat them in low temperature, stir fry, and then mix them into brown rice, bean dish. They're great with everything, but let's get more mushrooms into our body. That's the latest in health and healing. We're 25 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I take a lot of time to select audio clips that I believe give us some insight. We have a phenomenal roster of some 100 of the greatest minds on the planet lined up over the next 6 months as guests. We do a lot of programming way in advance. These are on those topics to make us think. This one is about an opinion piece. The super rich are damaging the environment. I agree with that. Here we go.
I'm Danny Dorling. I'm a professor of geography at the University of Oxford. And in my very humble opinion, one of the worst things about high economic inequality is that it damages the environment. High economic inequality is extremely damaging for the environment because the greedy do not know how to control themselves. Thomas Piketty, who's a brilliant economist from Paris, has done incredible detailed work recently looking at the consumption and pollution patterns of the richest 1%. And he has shown that the richest 1% disproportionately contribute to greenhouse gases and to carbon pollution and are damaging our planet. This is because they buy so many things that they do not need because money is not an issue for them. It's because they have so many homes that they travel between. It's because when they don't travel in a sustainable way. At the extreme, they're flying in private jets. There isn't a better way to heat up the planet and damage our environment than to fly in a private jet. And we need to learn the importance of this because climate change is the biggest threat that we're facing. And we're partly facing it because we're allowing the greedy people in our societies to carry on being greedy. And we're not controlling them for the good of everybody. In more unequal countries in the world, everybody actually buys more. The poor buy more in the United States than the poor buy anywhere else in the rich world. The poor in the UK buy more than the poor in Europe. Not because they've got more money, they go into debt. But because in an unequal country, you feel that you have to have these things because the people above you have them or have even more. And look at how the celebrities are behaving. They have even more. And you won't be happy unless you buy more, travel more, have more holidays and get into more debt. And all of this harms the environment more and more and more because it increases our pollution, it increases CO2, it increases our individual carbon footprints. In those countries in the rich world, where the 1% have less, where they're better controlled, where they're slightly more like the rest of us, the 1% tend to behave in a far better way than the 1% behave in the UK or the USA. And in societies which are more equal, the overall level of pollution is much lower in the rich world. The gap between the rich and the poor in the UK and the USA is wider than it's been since at least the 1930s or even the 1920s. But all's not lost. It can feel very bad if you're sitting in the UK or the USA at the moment. But in most countries, most OECD countries in the rich world, inequality is much lower than in the UK or the USA. And in the majority of countries, it is actually falling at the moment. And in these countries, people, despite the fact they have more disposable income, are buying less. They're doing less wasteful things with their time. They're taking fewer trips they don't need to take. They're not going to unnecessary meetings just to show their face. If they do travel, such as in Germany, they travel by train, not by plane. There's no reason to be pessimistic about the future. The UK and the USA are probably at a peak of economic inequality right now. It will almost certainly come down in the years and decades to come, decade after decade after decade. And we will slowly begin to learn what most other people in the rich world know, that having more and more money doesn't make you happier. It doesn't make your country more sustainable, and it doesn't solve.
To the contrary, I just read a wonderful, an inspired commentary by Chris Hedges this morning about a Indian tribe in the United States that prospered starting about in the 4th century. And what happened to it? It grew. It had out west in near Colorado, you'll see the remnants of these wall up the side of cliffs, all these homes. They overgrew. They depleted their resources, just like we're doing today. Now we don't have decades. We won't be around decades. But if we're smart, we can do a lot individually. We're not going to do anything collectively. There are governments, there are people around the world who are far more conscientious at dealing with climate change than we are. We're doing nothing. And individually, absolutely nothing. We're living in a bubble of optimism, a sense of utopia. Because, look, in so many places today, if you wake up in the morning, you're in a gated community, you walk outside, it's beautiful. You've got a golf course if you play golf. You've got lakes as just as part of the vista, tennis courts. You can go and dine in great restaurants. You can walk on a beach. And indeed, you earn that. You earn that right to spend your money the way you want. But the super rich can't have that. They can't be in a community with other people. They have to have their own walled mega mansion, the mega mansions. They can't just be seen on a normal flight. They pride themselves in their private flights. I'll give you an example. A normal private flight on a small jet, and they're not comfortable, by the way. These small jets are not comfortable. It's about $50,000 from New York to L.A. Now, if you sign up and you've got 30 of you using that jet, and sometimes you go 3 or 4 at a time, then you can get that flight down to around $12,000, $15,000. Well, on a commercial jet, you can take first class for probably around $900 to $1,000. Why the need to do it alone? And that's, they get used to that. Did you ever see those celebrities like Oprah Winfrey on David Geffen's yacht, like a 500-foot yacht? A 500-foot yacht is as large as one of those Carnival cruise ships. Why would someone need that? It takes a crew of 150 people to run it. And if you go out beyond land, what is the point of going any further? So let's say you're 8 miles out and you can't see land. Why go another 100 miles out? You're still not going to see land. It's irrelevant where you are at that point, unless you're traveling across the ocean. But why would you need to do that in a 500-foot yacht? Because it imparts a certain social panache, a certain class status. Look at me. I'm friends with someone who's so rich they have a private yacht of 500 feet, and I can be on that yacht. We do all these things in very childlike manner. Stupid, without anyone considering, should we? And the answer is no, especially when you consider debt. I read on the plane, and it says, this source is the Survey of Consumer Finances. The credit card debt right now for Americans, $931 billion. Mortgage debt's $8.8 trillion, and I know that is not an accurate figure. It's almost double that. Auto loans are $1.2 trillion. Student debt is $1.4 trillion for a total of $13 trillion. Okay, here's the true figures. Listen carefully what I'm going to share with you. Listen carefully. These are actual figures. We have debt of nearly $200 trillion. Our income, about $18 trillion, means that we are 1,200% debt to income, which means we're bankrupt. There's no way in the world we could pay one-tenth of that off. What does it come to? Well, the current gross domestic product is 19.8. But the total U.S. debt is $69.7 trillion. The national debt's $21 trillion. U.S. federal spending is $4 trillion. The state debt is $1.2 trillion. The local debt is $1.9 trillion. The total interest paid is $2.6 trillion. The total personal debt is $19 trillion. Mortgage debt is $15 trillion. Student loan, $1.5 trillion. Credit card, $1 trillion. Unpaid Social Security liability, underfunded, $17 trillion. They've been borrowing against that. And U.S. unfunded liability, $113 trillion. And that does not take into account currency and credit derivatives of $571 trillion. If that casino goes broke, we will pay for it. So you see, we are the most financially reckless and irresponsible country in world history. But if you happen to be living in one of those little bubble communities, what I call green zones, you won't recognize any of this. Now, we could forgive. First of all, we could cancel all credit derivatives. That takes that off the table completely. It's just a gamble anyhow. All they're doing is gambling. Something will up or something else will go down. And we could make, we could take the Social Security system to make sure that the government can no longer borrow against the Social Security Trust Fund, which has taken out over $2 trillion from. We could forgive all student debt. And we could forgive national debt because most of that's owed by the banks who didn't print the money and because they didn't have it against reserve currencies to begin with. It's a myth. It's a total myth. Everything you've been told about our banking system is a lie. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go over and play this. I don't know how much we'll get through. But it's not just about Syria. It's also about the Federal Reserve and our financial system. This will give you a real eye-opener as to why we're in Syria, why we went into Iraq, why we went into Afghanistan, why we are trying to go into other countries, has nothing to do with ISIS. We support ISIS. We fund ISIS. We fund terrorists all over the world. It has to do with control of the currency and protecting the dollar. Listen up on how the war in Syria is about oil, not ISIS.
Contrary to popular belief, conduct of nations on the international stage is almost never driven by moral considerations, but rather by a shadowy cocktail of money and geopolitics. As such, when you see the mouthpieces of the ruling class begin to demonize a foreign country, the first question on your mind should always be, what is actually at stake here? For some time now, Russia, China, Iran, and Syria have been in the crosshairs. Once you understand why, the events unfolding in the world right now will make much more sense. The U.S. dollar is a truly unique currency. In fact, its current design and its relationship to geopolitics is unlike any other in history. Though it has been the world reserve currency since 1945, this is not what makes it unique. Many currencies have held the reserve status off and on over the centuries, but what makes the dollar unique is the fact that since the early 1970s, it has been, with a few notable exceptions, the only currency used to buy and sell oil on the global market. Prior to 1971, the U.S. dollar was bound to the gold standard, at least officially. According to the IMF, by 1966, foreign central banks held $14 billion in U.S. dollars. However, the United States only had $3.2 billion in gold allocated to cover foreign holdings. Translation: the Federal Reserve was printing more money than it could actually back. The result was rampant inflation and a general flight from the dollar. In 1971, in what later came to be called the Nixon shock, President Nixon removed the dollar from the gold standard completely.
I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
At this point, the dollar became a pure debt-based currency. With debt-based currencies, money is literally loaned into existence. Approximately 70% of the money in circulation is created by ordinary banks, which are allowed to loan out more money than they actually have in their accounts. The rest is created by the Federal Reserve, which loans out money that they don't have, mostly the government. It's kind of like writing hot checks, except it's legal for banks. This practice, which is referred to as fractional reserve banking, is supposedly regulated by the Federal Reserve, an institution which just happens to be owned and controlled by a conglomerate of banks. And no agency or branch of government regulates the Federal Reserve.
What is the proper relationship, what should be the proper relationship between a chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. So long as that is in place and there is no evidence that the administration or the Congress or anybody else is requesting that we do things other than what we think is the appropriate thing, then what the relationships are don't frankly matter.
Now, to make things even more interesting, these fractional reserve loans have interest attached, but the money to pay that interest doesn't exist in the system. As a result, there's always more total debt than there is money in circulation. And in order to stay afloat, the economy must grow perpetually. This is obviously not sustainable. Now, you might be wondering how the dollar has maintained such a dominant position on the world stage for over 40 years, if it's really little more than an elaborate Ponzi scheme. Well, this is where the dollar meets geopolitics. In 1973, under the shadow of the artificial OPEC crisis, the Nixon administration began secret negotiations with the government of Saudi Arabia to establish what later came to be referred to as the petrodollar recycling system. Under the arrangement, Saudis would only sell their oil in U.S. dollars and would invest the majority of their excess profits into U.S. banks and capital markets. The IMF would then use this money to facilitate loans to oil importers who were having difficulties covering the increase in oil prices. The interest in payments on these loans would of course be denominated in U.S. dollars. This agreement was formalized in the U.S.-Saudi Arabian Joint Commission on Economic Cooperation, put together by Nixon's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, in 1974. The system was expanded to include the rest of OPEC by 1975. Though presented as a buffer to the recessionary effects of rising oil prices, this arrangement had a hidden side effect. It removed the traditional restraints on U.S. monetary policy. The Federal Reserve was now free to increase the money supply at will. The ever-increasing demand for oil would prevent a flight from the dollar, while distributing the inflationary consequences across the entire planet. The dollar went from being a gold-backed currency to an oil-backed currency. It also became America's primary export. Did you ever wonder how the U.S. economy has been able to stay afloat while running multi-billion dollar trade deficits for decades? Did you ever wonder how it is that the U.S. holds such a disproportionate amount of the world's wealth when 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer-based? In the modern era, fossil fuels make the world go round. They have become integrated into every aspect of civilization. Agriculture, transportation, plastics, heating, defense, medicine, and demand just keeps growing. As long as the world needs oil, and as long as oil is only sold in U.S. dollars, there will be a demand for U.S. dollars. And that demand is what gives the dollar its value. For the United States, this is a great deal. Dollars go out, either as paper or digits in a computer system, and real, tangible products and services come in. However, for the rest of the world, it's a very sneaky form of exploitation. Having global trade predominantly in dollars also provides Washington with a powerful financial weapon through sanctions. This is due to the fact that most large-scale dollar transactions are forced to pass through the U.S. This petrodollar system stood unchallenged until September of 2000, when Saddam Hussein announced his decision to switch Iraq's oil sales off of the dollar to euros. This was a direct attack on the dollar, and easily the most important geopolitical event of the year. But only one article in the Western media even mentioned it. In the same month that Saddam announced he was moving away from the dollar, an organization called the Project for a New American Century, of which Dick Cheney just happened to be a member, released a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. This document called for massive increases in U.S. military spending and a much more aggressive foreign policy in order to expand U.S. dominance worldwide. However, the document lamented that achieving these goals would take many years, quote, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor, end quote. 1 year later, they got it. Riding the emotional reaction to 9/11, the Bush administration was able to invade Afghanistan and Iraq and pass the Patriot Act all without any significant resistance.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you gotta come in. You gotta come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No, no." He says, we've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq, why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And this wasn't a question of bad intelligence. This was a cold, calculated lie. And the decision to invade was made in full knowledge of the disaster that would follow.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it, the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq, the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you've threatened the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take it.
They knew exactly what was going to happen. But in 2003, they did it anyway. Once Iraqi oil fields were under U.S. control, oil sales were immediately switched back to the dollar. Mission accomplished. Soon after the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration attempted to extend these wars to Iran. Supposedly, the Iranian government was working to build a nuclear weapon. After the Iraq fiasco, Washington's credibility was severely damaged. As a result, they were unable to muster international or domestic support for an intervention. Their efforts were further sabotaged by elements within the CIA and Mossad, who came forward to state that Iran had not even made the decision to develop nuclear weapons, much less begin an attempt. However, the demonization campaign against Iran continued, even into the Obama administration. Why? Well, might it have something to do with the fact that since 2004, Iran has been in the process of organizing an independent oil bourse? The Iranians were building their own oil market, and it wasn't going to be tied to the dollar. The first shipments of oil were sold through this market in July of 2011. Unable to get the war that they wanted, the U.S. used the U.N. to impose sanctions against Iran. The goal of the sanctions was to topple the Iranian regime. While this did inflict damage on the Iranian economy, the measures failed to destabilize the country. This was due in large part to Russia's assistance in bypassing U.S. banking restrictions. In February of 2009, Muammar Gaddafi was named chairman of the African Union. He immediately proposed the formation of a unified state with a single currency. It was the nature of that proposed currency that got him killed. In March of 2009, the African Union released a document entitled Towards a Single African Currency. Pages 106 and 107 of that document specifically discussed the benefits and technicalities of running the African Central Bank under a gold standard. On page 94, it explicitly states that the key to the success of the African Monetary Union would be the, quote, eventual linking of a single African currency to the most monetary of all commodities, gold. In 2011, the CIA moved into Libya and began backing militant groups in their campaign to topple Gaddafi. And the US and NATO pushed through and stretched a UN no-fly zone resolution to tip the balance with airstrikes. The presence of Al-Qaeda extremists among these rebel fighters was swept under the rug. Libya, like Iran and Iraq, had committed the unforgivable crime of challenging the US dollar. The NATO intervention in Libya segued into a covert war on Syria. The armories of the Libyan government were looted, and the weapons were shipped via Turkey to Syrian rebels working to topple Assad. It was already clear at this point that a large percentage of these fighters had ties to terrorist organizations. However, the U.S. national security apparatus viewed this as a necessary evil. In fact, the Council on Foreign Relations published an article in 2012 stating that, quote, the influx of jihadis brings discipline, religious fervor, battle experience from Iraq, funding from Sunni sympathizers in the Gulf, and most importantly, deadly results. In short, the FSA needs al-Qaeda now, end quote. In 2013, these same al-Qaeda-linked Syrian rebels launched two sarin gas attacks. This was an attempt to frame Assad and muster international support for military intervention. Fortunately, they were exposed by UN and Russian investigators, and the push for airstrikes completely fell apart when Russia stepped in to broker a diplomatic solution. The campaign for regime change in Syria, as in Libya, has been presented in terms of human rights. Obviously, this isn't the real motive. In 2009, Qatar put forth a proposal to run a natural gas pipeline through Syria and Turkey to Europe. Assad, however, rejected this. And in 2011, he forged a pact with Iraq and Iran to build a pipeline eastward, cutting Qatar and Saudi Arabia out of the loop completely. Not surprisingly, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey have been the most aggressive regional players in the push to topple the Syrian government. But why would this pipeline dispute put Syria in Washington's crosshairs? Three reasons. One, this pipeline arrangement would significantly strengthen Iran's position, allowing them to export to European markets without having to pass through any of Washington's allies. This obviously reduces the US government's leverage. Two, Syria is Iran's closest ally. Its collapse would inherently weaken Iran. And three, Syria and Iran have a mutual defense agreement. The US intervention in Syria could open the door to open conflict with Iran. In February of 2014, this global chess game heated up in a new venue, Ukraine. The real target, however, was Russia. You see, Russia just happens to be the world's second largest oil exporter. And not only have they been a thorn in Washington's side diplomatically, but they also opened up an energy bourse in 2008 with sales denominated in rubles and gold. Russia has also been in the process of organizing a Eurasian Economic Union, which includes plans to adopt a common currency unit and which is slated to have its own independent energy market. Leading up to the crisis, Ukraine had been presented with a choice: either join the EU under an association agreement or join the Eurasian Union. The EU insisted that this was an either-or proposition. Ukraine couldn't join both. Russia, on the other hand, asserted that joining both posed no issue. President Yanukovych decided to go with Russia. In response, the US national security apparatus did what it does best. It toppled Yanukovych and installed a puppet government. To see the full evidence of Washington's involvement in the coup, watch the Ukraine crisis, which you're not being told. Though this all seemed to be going well at first, the US quickly lost control of the situation. Crimea held a referendum, and the people voted overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and reunify with Russia. The transition was orderly and peaceful. No one was killed. Yet the West immediately framed the entire event as an act of Russian aggression. And this became the go-to mantra from that point on. Crimea is important geostrategically because of its position in the Black Sea, which allows for the projection of naval power into the Mediterranean. Now, the US has been pushing for Ukraine's inclusion into NATO for years now. Such a move would place US forces right on Russia's border, and could have potentially resulted in Russia losing their naval base in Crimea. This is why Russia immediately accepted the results of the Crimean referendum and quickly consolidated the territory. Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, two regions declared independence from Kiev and held referendums of their own, the results of which overwhelmingly favored self-rule. Kiev responded to this with what they referred to as anti-terrorist operations. In practice, this was a massive and indiscriminate shelling campaign which killed thousands of civilians. Apparently, killing civilians didn't qualify as aggression to the West. In fact, the IMF explicitly warned the provisional government that their $17 billion loan package could be in danger if they were not able to put down the uprising in eastern Ukraine. While the war against eastern Ukraine was raging, elections were held and Petro Poroshenko was elected president. Turns out that Poroshenko was exposed by a leaked diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks in 2008 as having worked as a mole for the US State Department since 2006. They referred to him as our Ukraine insider, and much of the cable referred to information that he was providing. Having a puppet in place, however, hasn't turned out to be enough to give Washington the upper hand in this crisis. What does Washington do when they have no other leverage? They impose sanctions, they demonize, and they saber rattle. This isn't a very good strategy when dealing with Russia. In fact, it's already backfired. Sanctions have merely pushed Russia and China into closer cooperation and have accelerated Russia's de-dollarization agenda. And in spite of the rhetoric, this has not led to Russia being isolated. The US and NATO have put a wedge between themselves and Russia, but not between Russia and the rest of the world. This new anti-dollar axis goes deeper than economics. These countries understand what's at stake here. This is why, in the wake of the Ukrainian crisis, China has proposed a new Eurasian Security Pact, which would include Russia and Iran. Consider the implications here as the Obama administration begins bombing in Syria, which also has a mutual defense agreement with Iran. This is not the Cold War 2.0. This is World War 3.0. The masses may not have figured it out yet, but history will remember it that way. Alliances are solidifying and hot wars are underway on multiple fronts. If the provocations and proxy wars continue, it's only a matter of time before the big players confront each other directly, and that is a recipe for disaster. Does all of this sound insane to you? Oh, you're right. The people running the world right now are insane, and the public is sleepwalking into a tragedy. If you want to alter the course that we are on, there's only one way to do it. We have to wake up that public. Even the most powerful weapons of war are neutralized if you reach the mind of the man behind the trigger. How do we wake the masses, you ask? Don't wait for someone else to answer that for you. Get creative. Act like your children's and grandchildren's futures depend on it. Because they do. If this message resonates with you, then spread it.
All right. Now, he shared a lot, and tomorrow I'll share more. As I predicted, there was no gas, sarin gas attack. There was provocation, but that was by the White Helmets. And the media in the United States supported the White Helmets uncritically. And the idea that France, the United States, and Great Britain should go in and bomb there. Now inspectors are on the ground, journalists are on the ground, and they're not finding anything whatsoever to back up the justification for this bombing. We told you so. The good news is that it doesn't seem as anyone was killed, at least at this moment. I don't have any reports of people being killed. But when it can be shown, and it will over the next 2 or 3 months, that our government and the neocons and the president and the deep state all work together to do this attack, that will do it for Trump's second go-around as president. That's just not going to happen. And it'll open it up for more people to go towards someone who insists on us not in going in and regime changing. And the only person right now, or the most likely person right now, would be Bernie Sanders. But more on all this tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.